We'll start. So we all know this Thursday is Asar B'Tevet, and the fast day. But some of us might not know all the reasons for Asar B'Tevet. What's some thoughts? Why do we fast on Asar B'Tevet? The classic reason, the siege of Yerushalayim, right? That's sources 1 and 2. Source 1, Chayavim Mis'anos on various fasts, including Asar B'Tevet, because of various fasts. Second source, Asar B'Tevet, Shabbos Samach Melech Bagel Nebuchadnezzar Rush al Yerushalayim. That's when the siege happened. And we mark the date by fasting. But actually, there are a couple of other reasons why we fast on Asar B'Tevet.
St. Peter.
Sorry?
St. Peter.
I wasn't going to go in that direction. But there's two other ones at least that are brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, really, more traditionally than St. Peter. Anyone know offhand? Septuagint. Okay, so that's where our topic's going to come in. So source number 3, the Shulchan Aruch has a listing from an earlier source we're going to see in a bit of other various days when bad things happen. Days that one, it's proper to fast on. It's not really obligatory. It's sort of a nice thing because of bad things that happened historically. And in Sif Beis, he points out in source 3, Bishmona b'teves nichtava Torah Yevanis. The 8th day of Teves, the Torah was written in Greek, was translated into Greek. That's what we'll see in a bit, is the Septuagint. The translation Septuagint means, how's everyone's Greek? What does Septuagint mean? 70. Right? The 70, the translation by 70 people, maybe 72, we'll get to that, of the Torah into Greek. That happened on the 8th day of Teves, and that's a reason to fast. Nithla Torah Yevanis be made Talmai Amelch, King Talmi, v'hayachoshech ba'olam shloshe yamim. The world was dark for 3 days. As a result, it was a bad thing. We're going to figure out exactly why. And that the 8th of Teves, and then another thing, on the 9th day of Teves, Bitesbo, Lo Noza Izat Sar Shirobo, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't know what the issue is, but the Mishnah Berurah points out, Uvislivo Shalanu, source 4, Isa Shemes Ezra Sofer. This is the day that Ezra died. Ezra is an important person. To mark his death, we fast on the 9th. Our practice is, people don't fast on the 8th or 9th of Teves. Raise your hand if you're fasting tomorrow. Right? So, but we fast on the 10th, and it's generally assumed to include the tsaros of the 8th and 9th, the various things that happened on the 8th and 9th, including the translation of the Torah into Greek, and the death of Ezra, among other things, maybe something to do with Peter as well, as Elinatan pointed out, but that's less of a traditional explanation. These are all marked on Asar B'Tevet on Thursday. So this is very timely, right? We can prepare for the fast day on Thursday. By thinking a little bit about the Septuagint. Also, we're going to touch on issues relating to Greek culture and Jewish culture, and that will tie into Hanukkah. So this is like the Chol HaMoed of discussion of Greek culture and Torah culture between Hanukkah and at least Ches Teves, maybe even Asar B'Teves. These are the 2 weeks a year where we think about it. The rest of the year, we maybe take things for granted in one direction or another. So before we get to the Gemara and other more traditional sources about the translation of the Torah into Greek, source 5 here is the letter of Aristeus. It's written in the 2nd century BCE by Alexandrian Jews, not part of the Tanakh, in case you didn't notice, not quite a canonical source, but as a historical source, very important for understanding what Alexandrian Jews were thinking in the 2nd century BCE and thereabouts. And there's actually an account of the translation of the Torah into Greek, very similar to the one we're going to see in the Gemara. We're not going to read this whole piece inside, but it's actually also dated to the time of King Ptolemy, just like we saw in the Shulchan Aruch, and he's trying to get all the books, have a library with all the books in the world. That's his goal, sort of like a Library of Congress, I guess, the Ptolemaic Congress. But there's a problem. The Torah is written in Hebrew. How are you going to get the Torah in a language that someone will actually understand? So they said, let's commission a translation into Greek, and they commissioned the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, to find men of the finest character and the highest culture, and they selected 6 people, one from each of the shvatim. So that's a total of 72 people, right? 12 shvatim. They got 72 people together. They put them all in one room, not in separate rooms, as we'll see in the Gemara, and they translated the Torah into Greek in 72 days. And they were very happy with this translation. Demetrius, the head librarian, was very excited about it. And just look at the last few lines of source 5 here. After the books had been read, the priests and the elders, the translators, the Jewish community, the people stood up and said, since so excellent and sacred and accurate a translation had been made, the perfect translation, it was only right that it should remain as it was and no alteration should be made in it. You can't change the Torah at all. What does that sound a little bit like? No, don't make any changes to the Torah.
Devarim,
right, the Torah, right, the Hebrew Torah says, Lo Sasurim and Adavar, right, don't, and Baal Tosef and Baal Tigger, you can't add, you can't subtract. They, sounds like they're applying that to the Greek translation, right? They're saying the same thing. Don't make any changes. And everyone agreed and they made a curse that anyone who alters either by adding anything or changing in any way, whatever, any of the words would have been written or making any omission would be guilty, would have that curse befall them. So really, they saw the Torah's translation into Greek. This is a wonderful thing, the Jewish community thought at the time. And really, it's almost like a new Torah. You can't change any word of it. This translation is perfect. We see elsewhere in Philo, philosopher in the first century, also in Alexandria, he also assumes that the Torah in Greek is perfect and the translation is perfect and you can't modify it. He had that same understanding 2 centuries later. So this really, at least for the Alexandrian Jews, who probably were pretty different than at least some other Jews, that we're going to see that the canonical sources reflect. But for a lot of Jews, they thought this is really a wonderful thing. Torah is translated to Greek. You know, this elevated culture now can have Torah as part of it as well. These were Greek-speaking Jews. That's what they spoke in Alexandria at the time. And now they have the Torah written. It's almost like, you know, think about how did an art scroll feel, or how did the, you know, firm Jews feel when art scroll translated the Torah into English, or the Babylonian Talmud into English, right? They had a big celebration. It's a wonderful thing. We translated all of Shas into English, and they held a big party celebrating that. So that sounds very similar to what these Jews felt. Okay, we'll take a quick question or two now.
A lot of Chachamim try to ask it, the art scroll thing.
That's true, but that's not the mainstream position. Yes.
Did the Alexandrian Jews not know Hebrew because
many did not, and we'll see the Gemara about the differences in a moment. Philo, it's not clear whether Philo actually read the, as a scholar, knew the Torah very well. It's not clear whether he actually was reading it in Hebrew or was only reading it in Greek. So the Gemara's version of the story, source number 6, is going to be similar in many different ways. The Tanya Masa B'Talmei HaMelech, Shekine Shem Shnayim Zekeinim, King Talmi gathered 72 elders, just like in the story, in the letter of Aristeus. The Yekinisim B'Shivim Shnayim Batim, change of alteration, there are 72 separate rooms, each one was put in their own room. The Logilu HaMamakin, so we didn't tell them why they were getting together, it was sort of a surprise. He went to each one, told them to translate or write the Torah in Greek. God gave some sort of counsel to each person. They ended up translating the Torah exactly the same. It's fairly miraculously, right? You have 72 people, each in a separate room. They all translated the Torah exactly the same way, including, as we're going to see, some alterations, some changes from the literal meaning of the Hebrew. They changed that into the Greek, and they all changed it in exactly the same way. Now, we say this is a miracle. 72 and 72 separate rooms they were able to translate. It's been pointed out, it might actually be a bigger miracle if you put all 72 of them in the same room and somehow they would agree. But nevertheless, that's the Gemara's version of the story. And it's going to point to 13 different alterations. We'll look quickly at a couple of them. Kasvulo, they wrote the following, Elohim bara bracious, which they wrote in Greek, but they switched the order. Instead of in the beginning, God created, bracious bar Elohim, they have Elohim bara bracious, God created in the beginning, etc. Why? Presumably, so you don't think that this being, gracious, created God. E'eseh Adam b'tzelem u'vidmus, rather than na'aseh Adam b'tzalmenu v'chidmusenu, let us create man or person in our form and in our image, which would sound both like there are multiple gods or divine beings, and that a person actually looks like God. That was modified, right? Let me, the one God, create a person with a form and an image, right? Not in my image. It doesn't even correct to have one God and a person in God's image. It's just a form and an image. And another one, we don't say that God completed his work on the seventh day, which is what the Torah says. We understand it to mean God finished right before. But to prevent any confusion, they say God finished on the sixth day, completed on the sixth day, and stopped on the seventh. So they made various changes. Now, as we saw in the Shulchan Aruch, this is seen as a bad thing, this translation. It's not generally seen as a good thing. The question is, why is that? What is bad about the translation? So we'll look at a few different sources in a moment. Before we do, just a couple of the sources before the Shulchan Aruch that he was using. Source number 8, just if you flip to page 3, Megillas Tanis Basra. Some of us may know what Megillas Tanis is, a listing of all the days for celebration. There was a later text, Megillas Tanis Basra, which listed the days for fasting or for mourning. And one of those days is Shmona Bateves. This is where the Shulchan Aruch gets his he's listing from. Mishmona Mateves Nifta Torah Bimei Talmai Amalek Yvanis. The Torah was written in Greek in the days of Talmai on the 8th of Teves. Ve'achoshat Bala Olam Shloshi Yomim. Darkness entered the world for 3 days. Ve'tisha Bo, Lokas Rusin, Ava'afan, the 9th, you don't know what it was, on the 10th, there was the, they encircled Jerusalem. So again, that same idea that they translated the Torah and that led to darkness. I guess we're gonna be thinking in terms of general knowledge and Torah. So I don't know, just curious, who's ever heard from a Haredi teacher at some point that you know they call it the enlightenment to bring general wisdom. Really, it's the endarkenment. Who's heard that drasha? Okay, we got a couple on the side. So I'm carrying that baggage from my upbringing. But you know, it comes at this makor, this source really says that, right? They translated the Torah. They thought the Jews in Alexandria thought it was great. Thought it was a wonderful thing, so much wisdom. But it's not the enlightenment; it's the endarkenment. There was darkness in the world for 3 days. So you know, this is a good resource for that that drasha. But we're going to see it maybe a bit more complicated. Source number 9, text from Rav Sadia Gaon, a poem coming from his school. Yes. It seems like it's drawing off of Choshech, right? The 3 days. Oh, interesting. That's an interesting idea. That the darkness, not just it's bad, but you're saying it's darkness in the sense that it gave Jews cover in some sense.
Yeah.
And because the translation, they modified things, it's covered for that or covered for something else?
But like, here's that image, right? Of like the 3 days of darkness, where like, the difference between
things,
right. Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, okay, worth thinking about. So it's from Sadi Gon, another source for this idea. Az dos bi mikra kalsa ruchi b'chodesh zeh ke nechteva das yevanis v'chein v'yamesh choshech, which is a direct quote of Shmos, the darkness in Egypt. Shloches yamim ugzartim ta'anis. So right, this seems to be the source, or at least the parallel to because Tanis Basra, they translated the Torah and the darkness was felt for 3 days, and that's why I declared it as a fast. And you know, indeed, at one point, that was a standard fast. Now we incorporate it into our Sarbat Tevis. It's very quick, but then we have to move on.
Didn't Rav Sadia Gaon himself translate the Torah in Arabic?
Yes. Yeah, so okay, so we're going to get to that question, right? So we have, what exactly is this that we don't believe in translating things? I mean, I think the Art Scroll example is another case we might wonder about. So there's a few different explanations given among classical sources. One, going back, if you can flip back to page 2, source 7, Meseches Ketana of Sefer Torah, short tractate, not quite canonical about Sifrei Torah. It talks about you can't write Torahs in various alternate versions with a different script, with a different language. You can't write it in Greek. On this opinion, we'll see there's a dispute. And then they tell the story. Shivim Zekanim Kasim Kol Torah L'Talmai Melech Lashon Yevanis, the translation by those 70 people. Also Yom Kasha L'Yisrael Ki Yom She'asu Bo'es Ha'egel. That day was as difficult as the day they made the golden calf. So that's another image, also from Book of Exodus, Sefer Shmos, worth thinking about. And why was this so bad? Shelo haisa Torah yechola lehitargem kol tzarka. The Torah can't really be translated properly. So it must be what they did was an improper translation of sorts. And an improper translation is a reason for mourning. Shlosha sedavar shinuba, then it lists the 13 changes. So that's one reason. You can't really translate the Torah properly into Greek. And therefore, that's worth mourning. We're going to look at a couple other reasons. Source number 10, another piyut, Yosef ibn Abitur. Diachani b'shmona bo smalis v'yemanis. They put me down or destroyed me on the eighth of Tevis, with their left and right hand. Shloshay yamim nikbati b'tanis. 3 days I set as a fast. If you think about it, right? 3 days. That's the 8th, 9th, and 10th. So we're sort of keeping that practice a little bit. Umelach yavan ansani lichtov das yevanis. The king of Greece, Helmi, forced me to translate to write it in the Greek practice, the Greek language. On my back, they plowed and lengthened their furrows. So it's a nice poem. But what sense do you get? What's the problematic aspect of this translation? At least what's emphasized.
It's against his will.
It's the coercive nature of it, right? Maybe if it had been like a nice art scroll project, everyone's happy, that would be fine. But if someone puts a gun to your head and says, translate the Torah, then maybe it's not so good anymore. So at least that seems to give a little bit of a different flavor. It doesn't seem like there's a problem. At least they don't say there's a problem with the translation per se, as much as the coercion. Source number 11, a listing of fast days that we found in the Cairo Geniza. Again, it talks about the fast at the end. It says, why was this bad? Lefi shelo haisa Torah tzricha lihitargem kol tzarka. Because the Torah is not supposed to be translated properly. Right? Earlier we saw a source saying that it wasn't translated properly, and presumably that's a bad thing. Here we're saying the problem is actually that it was translated properly. That's the problem. If you're translating the Torah properly, there's something wrong with that. Why is that the case? So one explanation we'll see in the next source, but it may be worth holding that thought. But the next source is a bit of a later list of fast days, and they have a slightly modified explanation. What's the problem? The translation was fine, the quality and whatnot, but the Torah is only supposed to be translated for Jews. The Torah is meant for Jews, not for other people. We shouldn't be translating the Torah and just letting anyone read it, Jew or non-Jew. The Torah is just for Jews. So really, we've seen four different explanations, or at least four different emphases here. Two of them are about the quality of the translation. One of them saying the Torah can't be translated properly into Greek, and that's bad. The other one saying the Torah can be translated properly into Greek, but it's not supposed to be translated properly. Maybe, I don't know, maybe if it was a bad translation, that would be better, right? Because there's something wrong with translating properly. And then the other two reasons are really about Jewish-non-Jewish relations, right? The fact that it was forced upon us by outsiders, or the fact that really the Torah is meant for Jews, it's not meant for anyone outside. Those are four different explanations from the medieval period, really, and a bit of a range of different ideas. Maybe we'll see if we can pull some of them together in a bit. Quick question.
On source 7, Haisa Torah, you hold the Targum called Sarka, is it possible to read that as saying that you're not allowed to translate?
Mm-hmm.
Not that you're unable to do so.
You could read it that way. Yeah, you could read it that way, and that would agree then with source 11 in a sense, right? That you can't, but you shouldn't. We'll see in a bit a couple of Gemara sources that have very similar language that will indicate that most likely if this was working with the previous sources, it means that it can't be. It's like a problem in the quality of the translation. Yeah. Yes, I like that idea very much, and we'll build on that in a few minutes. No, thank you. All right, so we have a couple of different explanations here, and I think in order to properly get at what these sources are telling us, or at least some of the views, we have to think more broadly about the relationship between Greek wisdom and Greek, and the Greek language, and Torah, and Judaism. And this is something that's been much discussed. It's a classic Hanukkah topic. Again, we're in the Chol Hamoed of Greek wisdom, so it's good that we're thinking about this now. I'll just quickly run through some of these sources. We don't have time to go into everything fully, but Mishnah and Sota points out various xeros, things that they decreed against at various points at various wars. And it says the second example of Pumus Shel Titus Gazra al Atros Kalos Vishal Yilamid Adam Espino Yevanis. At the time of the war of King Titus, they made a decree not for brides to wear crowns at weddings. This is currently a practice that they should. There's a whole discussion about that. Ask your local modern Orthodox rabbi or something. And they also made a gzera that a person shouldn't teach their son Greek. One thing I always found ironic about this Mishnah, I don't know if anyone, tell me the Semitic root of the word pulmos? It's because there is none, right? It's a Greek word. Polymos means war. So this is the very Mishnah that talks about the prohibition of studying Greek, prominently three times starting at the beginning of the Mishnah, has a Greek word in it. But in any event, there was a prohibition against studying Greek, and that's because, we're going to try to understand why, the Gemara in Sota, source 14, gives an explanation as to why this Gzera took place. At the time that there was the siege, or there was the war of the Hashmonaim, again, the historicity of these things, you can work that out if you want, that's not my interest here. That Hyrcanus was on the outside, Aristobulus was on the inside, they were fighting a war, and what would they do every day? What happens when you have a siege? There's no way to bring in various things. So right, so for example, the Karbanos, how are they going to bring a Karban Tamin? Every day you need, as a Kevin you need two sheep to bring in the Mikdash, but they had no access to sheep because the sheep, I guess they ran out of their resources of sheep. So what would they do? Both the people on the inside and the outside believed in the temple worship. They all were there were various parts of base Hashmonai. So what would they do? Hayasham Zakin Akhachayamakir every day, Bakol Yom Yom Hayu Mishal Shalin Dinar Mikupa Umal Nam Tsmin. They would trade, they would give money send money to the outside, and the outside would give, send sheep, I guess in a bucket of some sort, send sheep to the inside for the carbonos. Everyone wins that way, right? They're getting, probably they extorted them, they got a lot of money for the sheep. On the other hand, they both wanted the carbonos to happen, so they made sure that that happened. Hayasham zakin ashayam makir b'chachmas yuvanis. One wise elder, one elder knew chachmas yuvanis, knew the wisdom of Greek. Some people translate it like that. Maybe it just means knew the Greek language. That may be a better translation. La'az lahem b'chachmas yuvanis. He whispered to them in Greek and said the following. Kol zman she'oskin ba'avoda, einim sarim b'yedchem. As long as the Jews on the inside are doing the avoda, or bringing the sacrifices, they're not going to be given over to your hands. You're not going to win the war as long as they can bring the korbanos. They have just, I guess, the energy that gives them will allow them to keep fighting. So what did they do? L'machar shushu lahem dinar b'kupa. They gave them the money, as usual. V'helu lahem chazir. Rather than giving them a sheep, they gave them a pig, obviously unfit for karban, and in general consumption. Kevan shehigia l'chasi choma, when the pig was halfway up the wall, not siparnav, it stuck its hooves in the wall, and nizdaza eretz Yisrael arba meos parsa. The whole land of Israel shook, I guess, 400 parsa. It really, the whole thing... It's pretty big. I don't think it's bigger than Israel, but it's pretty big. The whole nation really shook. Osa shah amru, aru adam shigadlo chazerim, v'aru adam shilami d'fno chachma silvanis. They made a gzera. Cursed is a person who, first of all, raises pigs. In general, raising pigs is not the best thing. I taught this source last week, and someone said that their uncle was a pig raiser, so that was interesting. But generally, not a Jewish practice. And more pertinent for our purposes, cursed is a person who teaches his son Greek. Right? You shouldn't teach your children Greek. You should stay away from that. The only problem is, the Gemara challenges this a couple different ways. We're not going to go into all the examples. But it says, Chachas Yuvanis Miasira. Is it really true that you can't study Greek? Is that true? We know about Rabbi Yehuda quoting from Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. We heard about the story from Wendy earlier. They said, Elef Yiladim Hayu Beis Abba, my father had 1,000 children or descendants. Chamesh Meos Lamdu Torah, 500 of them studied Torah. Chamesh Meos Lamdu Chachmas Yuvanis, 500 studied Greek, right? They had, I guess, two majors or whatever in the family, right? There's the Hebrew major and the Greek major. So how could that be bad? And they say Shani shall base Rav Gamliel the Krovin Lumalthus Habu. The household of Rav Gamliel is different because they were close to the government. They needed to know Greek for political purposes. There was some sort of an exception there, so there seems to be an exception. But the general rule appears to be that studying Greek is not a good thing. Another example of that in source 15, Acher. Now we're talking about Acher, we discussed earlier. What was his deal? Why did he lose a place in the world to come? That's the broader context there. Zemer Yevani lo pasak mipume. He never stopped singing Greek songs. That's one thing. And Amru Alav, the other thing, the Shah Shehaya Omi Beis HaMedrash, Harbe Sifrei Minin Nosher Micheko. When you would get up from the Beis HaMedrash after learning all of these books of heretics, originally written in Greek, that's where the heretical books were written in those days, would fall out of his lap. Right? So again, you can like almost hear, at least I can, again, I'm just processing my education, but you can hear like the Musish was writing the Geisha music is bad, and then the reading the Kfira. But that's what he's getting. That's why he lost his place in the world to come. These are the various things that he did that were inappropriate. So it sounds like there's a general, at least from these sources, a pretty negative view towards Greek. And there are other sources as well that we didn't look at. On the other hand, though, there are some sources that seem pretty bullish on Greek. Source 16, talking about writing Sifrei Torah. In general, you can't write it there's a dispute whether you can write it in any language or really only in one language. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Af b'sfarim lo hitiru she'yikasvu el yavanis. You can only write a Sefer Torah in, other than Hebrew or Greek. Those are the only two languages you can write a Sefer Torah. There's something special about the Greek language that it's a valid language for writing the Sefer Torah. Both the Yerushalmi and the Bavli talk about this. We're not going to look at them inside, but they cite various sukkim about Yatel Kim Liyefes. That Yefes, who was the father of Yavan, did things, God made him nice. God made him a high-quality individual with a high-quality culture, and that we allow that. Or, Yafuso shall Yefes behave all shame, as the Bavli says. The beauty of Yefes, the beauty of the Greek language, you can have that in a tense of shame. You can translate the Torah into Greek for that reason, and only into Greek, according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Also remember, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is from the house of Rabbi Gamliel, where they learned Greek, right? Because they're Krovin Lamalfa. So it's the same family, part of that exception that he studied Greek. And again, there are other sources, we didn't go through this inside, but there are other sources that seem to indicate that Greek is a high quality thing, not just in general, but even for writing the Torah in Greek. Right, think about that for a second. We have sources that say that the translation of the Torah into Greek was a cause for mourning and fasting and darkness entering the world. There's another source of Shimon Gamliel says that's the only language you can translate the Torah into for valid use of the Torah. Right? You can't translate into just any language, only Greek. Right? So that's for the question before, right? The Torah can only be translated into Greek. So that sounds like the source that said it's bad to translate into Greek. It seems to be about quality, right? Some texts don't have the quality of being able to translate into Greek. Some other languages don't have the quality of being able to have the Torah translated into them, but Greek does. But still, we have these conflicting sources. One last example, source 19. This is neither saying that Greek wisdom is good or bad per se, but it's a question of competing resources, competing time. What about teaching your child Greek? Now, again, we saw some sources said it was a bad thing, right? And some there with an exception. So what does he say? You can teach them, it's fine, as long as you find the time that's neither morning nor night. You somehow find that sweet spot that's neither morning nor night, you can teach them, right? It sounds like there's no inherent problem, it's just a problem of time. There's only so many hours in the day. How could you possibly teach someone Greek? You have to be teaching them Torah. The joke people like to say about this is that, well, okay, Bena Shmashos, you take out your Greek textbook, not Yom, it's not Lila, maybe it's both, I don't know, maybe it's something else. That's you have your Greek Seder, so to speak. But this source is just to complicate things further. It's not bad per se, it's just we don't have time for it. So what's really going on here? Is Greek wisdom, is Greek language and culture a good thing or a bad thing? And is translating the Torah to Greek a good thing or a bad thing? To the extent that it's a bad thing, as we see as we fast, what exactly is the reason? Is it because the Torah can be translated into Greek, and that there's something wrong with doing that? Somehow Greek is special, and we should stay away from it. There's some concerns there. Is it because you're not translating the Torah properly? Is the Torah translated properly into Greek or not? So I think one thing it may be worth looking at, one thing it may be worth thinking about, is some theory of translation, what I call the problem of translation. So there's an article by Walter Benjamin, The Task of the Translator. He actually was, they claim he was influenced by Franz Rosenzweig. So this is really, he's a Talmud of the Lehrhaus, the original Lehrhaus, so to speak. Influenced by Franz Rosenzweig. He's a German philosopher, happened to be Jewish, but didn't write too much about Jewish things. In the early 20th century, he died tragically very young. And he talks about the challenges of translating. So he says, just as a tangent touches a circle lightly at but one point, establishing with this touch, rather than with the point, the law according to which it is to continue on a straight path to infinity. So the mashal here is, you have like a circle. The circle is the text being translated. And a translation, it doesn't like capture the circle. It captures one point at the edge of the circle, and there's like a tangent. And that's your translation, right? So you're not going to quite get what's in the circle. You'll get one aspect of it and run with it. A translation touches the original lightly and only at an infinitely small point of the sense, thereupon pursuing its own course according to the laws of fidelity, in the freedom of linguistic flux. So he's using a mashal from physics, but it's clear what the main point he's saying is that translation can't capture the original. You take some aspect of it and run with it. And then he's going to quote from this character, Rudolf Panwitz, which I think is very, very enlightening. No pun intended. Panwitz writes, "Our translations," about halfway down, "our translations, even the best ones, proceed from a mistaken premise. They want to turn Hindi, Greek, English," I'd throw in Hebrew, "into German, rather than turning German into Hindi, Greek, or English. Our translators have a far greater reverence for the usage of their own language than for the spirit of the foreign works. The basic error of the translator is that he preserves the state in which his own language happens to be, instead of allowing his language to be powerfully affected by the foreign tongue. If you skip a bit, he must expand and deepen his language by means of the foreign language." In other words, what he's arguing is, we all think you translate a text, you have to, okay, we have this text, we have this Hebrew text, we need to find the right Greek words to use to have that meaning fit. What he's saying is really you need to be able to modify the Greek language in order so that it can properly take in those words in translation. You can't just translate word for word, you need to somehow have the language that's being translated into be affected through that process. I would add to that, it goes both ways, right? Once you do that, you're affecting the language it's translated into, you're affecting the Greek, but you're also affecting the Torah, you're affecting the original when you translate it. Because in order for it to be, for it to recognize something as a translation, it has to serve as a bridge between the two languages, the language it starts out in and the language it ends up at. And, you know, I think it's often said that, that language isn't just a technical thing, the words you happen to use. Languages represent ideas, represent cultures. A translation of a text from one language into another is really a transfer, a bridge that, that allows for the transfer of culture both ways, between both of those, both of the sides, the original language and the language it's translated into. And if we use that idea, I think it can be really informative of what happened with the Greek translation. So is it possible to translate the Torah properly into Greek? In a sense, yes, right? Greek is it's a beautiful language that has these qualities. It's on such a high level, we have the ability to translate it into Greek. At the same time, can you translate the Torah properly into Greek? Well, no, not really. There's something that's lost in that translation. Or better, there's something on each side of the equation, both the Hebrew and the Greek, that's mutually influenced by the other side. Now, sometimes that influence can be good, right? The Jews of Alexandria were very happy with the influence. But at times, there can be something lost in translation, so to speak. And I'll give two examples, one a detailed type example, one a general one, and then we'll have questions, and then we'll move to the next part, hopefully very quickly. So what's lost in translation? If you saw the original, the source we had from the Gemara, the changes, the 13 changes that were made, so you need to change Bereishis bara Elokim into Elokim bara Bereishis. They had to erase the whole concept of people being created, B'Tselem Elokim. These are both very important things. The first three words of the Torah, I would have liked that to stay in the same order. Or the concept that a person is in the image of God. I think that's like a central core concept of Judaism. I wouldn't want that affected. And yet, if they would have translated slavishly, word for word, you would have led to very bad things. You would have led to kfira, in a sense, right? You think that some other being called gracious created God. You would think that people are in the image of God because people are like God. Gods and humans are on the same plane. And that, on the detail level, are modifications to the translation that happened. And in order to build that bridge between the two sides, you needed to modify the Hebrew, you needed to modify the Torah, and something is really lost in translation. The other point is a much broader point that I think actually comes out of those examples, but is more broadly true. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who, if anyone has something to say about Orthodox perspectives on translating or looking at external cultures, he's probably the first person you'd look at. Talks about, we're not going to be able to read these inside sources 21 and 22, about the various differences between Greek wisdom and culture and Jewish wisdom and culture. Greek culture did a lot of wonderful things, both the aesthetics of it and the placing of people on a pedestal. That anthropocentrism, putting man at the middle, that's an important thing. And for those who know Rav Lichtenstein, he's a self-proclaimed religious humanist. So he really believed in humanism. Humanism is an important principle. We need to place humans, people, at the center of our consciousness to a certain extent. The problem is that Greek culture made humans the be-all and end-all. Gods themselves, first of all, there were many, but also gods were just sort of slightly stronger humans, right? Think Hercules or whatever it is. They're just human characters with superpowers. They're like mutants. I don't know, whatever. There's no qualitative difference between people and gods. At the same, and in addition, since there's no god, there's no mitzvah, there's no commander. So people can't be commanded. People can't have limitations. People can really, humanity can understand everything, can explain everything, and there's no limitation, there's no command, there's no ethical impulse either, Rav Lichtenstein writes, to help others. Among other things, he draws upon the work of Matthew Arnold on Hebraism and Hellenism, where he talks about that, how the ethical impulse exists in Judaism and Hebraism, but not in Hellenism, not in Greek wisdom, because it's all about being, maximizing human creativity and human aesthetics and human power at the expense of recognizing a god and at the expense of assisting others. And if we think about that, right, that was why the translation on the detail level reflected that problem of translation, because or you couldn't say Bereishis bara Elokim because the idea that there can be more than one god is a Greek idea, and in Greek that means something very different. That might mean that there is another god, or you can't say that a people are B'Tselem Elokim because it's obvious to someone who reads the Torah that God is on one plane and all humans are on a different plane. There's no havamina, there's no possible thought that there's any real similarity between them. So you can say that people are B'Tselem Elokim in the sense that there's some aspect of divinity in human existence. But if you're writing in Greek, you can't say that. You can't get away with that. People will be confused and think that people and gods are actually on the same plane. So there was a need to modify the translation, which is really a reason to mourn, given the nature of the Greek language. Now, Rav Lichtenstein himself was very supportive of bringing in Greek culture. And not only that, he talked about Matthew Arnold, that same Matthew Arnold, as looking for the best that has been thought and said in the world, which really stems from Greek culture, in a sense. Greek culture is the founding, in a sense, of Western culture, or at least Greek culture and Jewish culture came together to found the West. And so how does that work? If we have all these dangers, you have to, you know, fast for 3 days, or darkness enters the world. I think Rav Lichtenstein, and he expressed this better than I can, but we don't have time to read it, says that's the challenge. You have to make sure you're only seeking out the best things. You have to understand that what you're doing is bringing in something external. You have to accommodate. You have to allow for ways to perfect, to make sure that you don't fall prey to these challenges that translation brings about. And there have to be limits at a certain point. You say, okay, we don't read certain things. For example, Ayn Rand, he always said you shouldn't read, among other texts, things that won't help build you and you know, make your sensitivities higher and make your Torah greater, shouldn't be read. There's no value in reading them. You read only the best and only as a way of enhancing your Torah. So that, in a sense, is one way of looking at Greek wisdom, Greek language, translating the Torah into Greek. And we'll see, it gets a bit more complicated, but there was a hand that I wanted to address. Yeah, no, that's a great example. And I think that some of the other 13 things that they changed are metaphors and turns of phrase that work in Hebrew and don't work in Greek. So that's an important point too, and that's part of the bigger picture. I chose to focus on some of the more, you know, the more, I guess, ethical or culturally tinged examples because of the broader point. But yeah, that's definitely true. All right, so we're running out of time. We're going to do this quick. Rav Lichtenstein builds this whole edifice, and please read his articles. I'm a Talmud of his, and I think everyone should read all of his articles about Torah and Western thought and everything else. But he builds a whole system where, you know, it's edifying to not only study Torah, but to Kabbalah, Emes, Mimi, Shamara, as the Rambam said. He said it in Arabic, so that's a translation, but whatever. accept the truth from wherever it comes, and wisdom from everywhere, and often that's people who aren't Jewish. Milton and Cardinal Newman and Shakespeare and Aristotle, just to give a few examples from source 23 here. And in a sense, I'm arguing this is really a translation project. A translation project where you have to be very careful because of the dangers of translation, because of what we learn from Ches Tevis, the translation of the Torah into Greek in the Septuagint. You have to be very careful about what you're bringing into this translation project and how to make it work. And that's the modern Orthodox, generally, justification for engaging in Western culture is Rav Lichtenstein's approach. Now, the problem is, if you've been reading the Lehrer House, you'll know that at least, you know, some of us are thinking about this, that we're not currently in the modern period. We're at least in, if not after, the postmodern period, right? We're to enter the new postmodern world. We're a few decades behind it. We think we're still modern these days. So what happens when you enter the postmodern era? And again, we've had some articles in Lehrer's, a couple of them we quoted here, but it really poses a major challenge to Rav Lichtenstein's approach. Source 25 here, originally written in 1986, this is really going back 30 years. Rav Lichtenstein writes that he talks about the essay he wrote in the 60s, which was on the sheet. And the second paragraph, I freely admit that during the intervening years between early 60s and 1986, confidence in culture in Matthew Arnold's sense, the study of perfection, right, the best of what's been written, has been generally shaken. And it gives several reasons, but one of them, high culture, the best that has been thought and said in the world, as Arnold defines literature, is less cherished than it once was. Interest in the humanities has waned, both within academia and outside of it, focus shifting to pragmatic and technological areas. He doesn't quite invoke postmodernism, but the move against humanities, and especially against the idea of focusing on high culture, as Arnold had it, is a fundamentally postmodern phenomenon. I think there's some aspects of that in this formulation by Rav Lichtenstein himself, but he's not the only one to note this shift. Source 26 by Sarah Ridner, who we have right here in our room, I guess in some of her earlier writings, so I don't know, she may just claim that this is no longer her position, you can ask her later, writes as following. She quotes consideration of synthesis from a Torah point of view, Rav Lichtenstein's powerful case for the spiritual value of a strong secular education, and again, the idea that the humanities deepen our understanding of man, his nature, functions, and duties. And her response, when I first read those words, They strengthened her interest in going to college, but the more I became attuned to the basic problems of moral and religious thought, the more I questioned how exactly they were going to contribute towards a deepened spiritual involvement. This has become some of the most searching problems raised by the literature I've encountered have involved man's sense of isolation in the universe, the complexities of human conflicts in contrast to coherent moral and philosophical frameworks. Meaning, whereas I think on the Rav Lichtenstein model of Torah Umada, the goal is to sort of build a superstructure where everything builds on everything else, the Greek culture and the Torah all work together, and you end up with some grand narrative of being the perfectly halakhic and ethical person. The problem is it true anymore that reading literature, especially if you're not reading just the best of what's been written, but literature to reflect a variety of perspectives without privileging one type of literature over another, whether that still leads a person to the same place? And that's how literature works these days, as Sarah wrote. I still cannot imagine how Rav Lichtenstein's Torah-centered ideal of synthesis could function in a serious college English literature class, even with the most religiously grounded of students. The supplementary ancillary model of segregation Rav Lichtenstein lays out, however inspiring it is from a Torah point of view, does not create the kind of students who would make our English professors proud. That's just not where English literature is. That's not where the humanities are. They're postmodern. I think, right, you had a fair amount of postmodern professors, I'm guessing. And right, that's where the academy is at. So part of the challenge is, can this work nowadays? There's sources 27 through 30 are recent articles on the Lehrhaus by Gil Pearl originally, and responses by, among others, Roy Carmi, Roy Rothstein, Rafi Ice, all talking about this challenge. How do we cope with Torah Umada and with studying secular knowledge, and in general with the idea of Torah of a modern Orthodox community where we incorporate things beyond Torah proper in a world where the secular concepts are no longer edifying in the way they once were, and instead it's, you know, let's recognize there's a variety of perspectives. Let's not say that one thing is better than something else. Let's not say there's a grand narrative around which everything runs. But the Torah is about a grand narrative. The Torah is central, and everything else revolves around that. So how can we work forward nowadays in a postmodern era, at least for those who think in that way? How can we build a postmodern Orthodoxy? That was some of the debate on the Lehrhaus. Some people thought we could do it, maybe using Rav Shigar, a bunch of articles about that. Some people thought we couldn't do it. I'm not going to try to answer that debate. I just want to try, in the negative 3 minutes we have left, to shed a bit of light on this question and what the stakes are. And with that, jumping to the final source on postmodernism and translation, because this is all a translation project, we need to think about how translation works with postmodern thought. This is an article, a treatment of Frederick Jameson, who is a postmodern thinker, a treatment of his version of postmodernism, and there's a snippet that thinks about postmodernism from the perspective of translation. We'll start from about the fifth line. Each subsystem within culture in general, reflects a different realm of experience and has its own way of being understood, its own code, right? Everything you look at, texts, he's going to talk about art. A postmodern building, for example, may incorporate elements of ancient Egyptian, Gothic, Victorian, and modern architecture side by side. Skipping two lines, each element can be interpreted in terms of its own code, but there is no single code to tell us why they should be placed together in just the way they are, right? There's no grand narrative. An issue of People magazine is similar. I hope some people are interested in that. Articles about a movie star, a political leader, a homeless drifter may appear side by side. Each makes sense in terms of its own code. There's no clear reason, though, why they should all appear on the same page. Right? It happens to be you're putting all these things on a page, and there's nothing really tying them together. The same thing with culture. Right? Some things may have all sorts of aspects to them that have nothing to do with one another, that even compete with one another, and they just were thrown together. That's the world we live in. The next paragraph, we take in all the juxtaposed signs, accepting each as a discrete entity. We learn to focus on many signs simultaneously. This is the postmodern condition. We do not expect them to form a single overarching language. The best we can do is to translate the terms of one code into a roughly corresponding set of images in another code. This is called transcoding. Set about measuring what is sayable and thinkable in each of these codes, compare that to the conceptual possibilities of its competitors. So there's no perfect one-to-one translation. You can't say, here's one culture, here's another. Okay, I'll take what's valuable from here and bring it in, or even, you know, we'll work these two cultures side by side and we'll have a transfer of knowledge in each direction. It doesn't work that way. There's too many different things, too many different languages, as it were, to be translated. So there's no simple way of doing it. You end up being buffeted from all sides by various different texts, various different languages, and what you can do is do the best you can to have some version of this idea, but you can't really incorporate it fully. You can't build a grand narrative. So if Rav Lichtenstein says you need to build a grand narrative from Torah while incorporating Western knowledge and Western values and Western culture and ethics, that's not possible anymore. You can maybe take a piece from here, a piece from there, but you can't build that edifice. That's the postmodern perspective on things. As he writes, transcoding is the best we can hope for in the postmodern world. Culture remains a kaleidoscope of interacting images. It has no more meaning than the kaleidoscope we played with as children, right? You see all sorts of different things in the kaleidoscope. There's nothing really holding it together. So if that's the challenge, if that's what translation is like in the postmodern perspective, I think there's really a few questions that we have to ask when we think, is it possible to build a postmodern orthodoxy? Because really there's three different differences, I think, that we've seen so far, and feel free to suggest others that you've come up with. Number one is that there's no one-to-one translation. It's not like you have Greek wisdom, you have Torah wisdom, and you build a bridge and somehow fend off the bad parts and keep the good parts. That doesn't work anymore. Instead, it's from all sides, and maybe it's a lot harder to fend off the negative, and maybe it's harder to incorporate everything into one superstructure. Second, we no longer, when we think about literature, when we think about philosophy, we're not thinking about in postmodern perspective. We're not thinking about highbrow, but lowbrow or all brows, unibrow, I don't know, something. We're not thinking only about the highbrow, everything goes, right? It's not like Matthew Arnold said, and we've listened to him quoted many times, to take the best of what's been written in thought. We're just taking what's out there. We're taking different reflections of the human condition from different perspectives, and not necessarily the most, the strongest ones. And this leads to the third point, that it's no longer only about the most noble or the most ethical perspectives. Really, everything goes, and that leads to one of the challenges to postmodernism that was raised in some of the articles, actually, that it's narcissistic, right? It's self-serving. This is my perspective. I can't really appreciate someone else's perspective, and the challenge is how can I understand myself, really? So really, all of life and all of thought is a question of self-interpretation, because we don't really have full access to other people's perspectives, and that's a real challenge, because I think the Torah, as we saw from Rav Lichtenstein, the Torah believes it is ethical. Maybe it's different than Greek wisdom in that way. It believes in trying to understand other people, to help other people, to empathize. So between these three different shifts, from the modern to the postmodern, there's no more one-to-one translation. It's no longer highbrow. And there's the challenge at points of becoming self-centered. And actually, Rav Lichtenstein did say that about some aspects of Rav Shigar's thought. So our question is, are these challenges surmountable or not? First of all, are they true? Do you agree with them? That's a question everyone has to answer for themselves. But assuming they exist, are they surmountable? Or you might say, is this a qualitative difference or a quantitative difference? To use one of Lichtenstein's favorite questions. When we think about the difference between modern and postmodern, is it just, okay, you know, we had modern culture and we were able to translate that and assimilate that into Judaism. Now we have postmodern culture, there's some differences, but really it's just the same question. How do we translate that? Rav Shigar would certainly say, of course we can do that. We've incorporated other cultures throughout history. We're going to continue to do that. And I think one of the other articles that we ran in the Lair House by Miriam Feldman Kay made the same point. It's not like there's anything special about modernity that we're able to incorporate. Torah can always respond to the world around it. Or the other perspective is that really these three differences, or maybe some other differences, make it such that this is a qualitatively different endeavor. It's impossible to translate Greek wisdom, or not Greek wisdom in this case, right? Postmodern wisdom, the postmodern condition, our current regnant field of thought, it can't really be translated into Torah. And the only option is to say, you know, this is a Greek wisdom too far, or something like that, and that we have to just focus on our perspective and not really allow the external perspective to come in. So that's the question we have. You might say, can postmodernism be translated kol tzarka, properly translated and incorporated into Torah, or when we study that, when we incorporate it, do we risk bringing darkness into the world for 3 days? Thank you.